Good morning, everyone. Welcome. Bonjour, bienvenue. My name is Sherry Hills, and I'm the Acting Manager of Research and Strategic Planning at the Ontario Media Development Corporation. Also joining me from OMDC today is Arianna Moscote-Ferrer, Jen Brown, and Amanda Harris. I'm so glad you could all join us this morning for our first Ottawa Digital Dialogue breakfast session. We're very grateful to our venue sponsor, KPMG, who's graciously offered us this space and helped us with our planning. I'd like to introduce Mr. Jeff McDonald, Partner Tax Incentive Services at KPMG, who'd like to say a few words of welcome.
I wanted to thank everybody for joining us here today. I'm smart enough to know you're not here to see an accountant stand up and say much with respect to it, so I'll be 2 seconds. We're all waiting for other people to be speaking. But I really did want to thank you. It's amazing. This came out of a conversation several months ago following an ION event. So it's great to see people here. It's great to see the industry. I know there's been changes and stuff like that. It's good to have discussion. So welcome. If there's any questions, please let me know.
For those who don't know OMDC, the Ontario Media Development Corporation, we're an agency of the Government of Ontario, and our mandate is to build Ontario's creative economy, specifically the book and magazine publishing, film and television, interactive digital media, and music industries. We do this through a range of services, grants, tax credits, and events like this one today. At these breakfast sessions, we bring people together from the different creative media industries to talk about topics we think are of interest across the sectors. It's our hope that through today's session, you'll make some new connections, meet some new people, and take away some new ideas. This morning's topic is Let's Make a Deal, Negotiating Rights, License Fees, and Royalties for New Platforms. Quite a bit of research that OMDC has funded in the past few years has dealt with helping content producers go beyond the traditional revenue streams. Film and TV producers, game developers, music companies, book publishers, and digital magazines are all trying to find ways to license their content to different platforms. Particularly for small companies, negotiating terms can be a difficult prospect. As always, you can read the studies OMDC sponsors by going to the collaboration pages on our website and browsing the research area. Our moderator, Doug Murray, has a lot of experience helping content creators negotiate distribution platforms and other content owners to get their products seen and heard and to find new revenues. Doug Murray is here to give us an industry view from 30,000 feet and lead our discussion today. Doug Murray is a partner with leading Canadian entertainment firm Taylor Klein Obala LLP. Doug acts for a wide variety of film, TV, and new media producers, lenders, investors, artists, writers, and directors. Doug has extensive experience as production legal counsel, including handling rights acquisitions, co-production agreements, broadcast and licensing deals, performer agreements, financing tax credits, E&O insurance reviews, and distribution agreements for a long list of TV series and feature films. Our panelists today are John Bartlett from Kelp Records, Michael Dobbin from Quiet Revolution Pictures, and Scott Simpson from Bitheads. Thank you all for taking time to be with us and for sharing your ideas today. Please join me now in welcoming Doug Murray, John Bartlett, Michael Dobbin, and Scott Simpson. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Sherry. I'm very excited to be here. I'm really glad that you invited me to come down and be part of this all-star panel. To not only talk about, but learn more about, taking content. It's really kind of about taking stories and telling them across multiple platforms. At least that's how we like to view it. And really seeing how that's being done. Because it's not just about, the different platforms and how they're being exploited. It's about how that's being done. Who are the content holders reaching out to? And when they do, what kind of relationships are they striking? Is it a kind of work for hire scenarios? Is it collaborations? Is it co-production agreements? And then when they do come together and they assess whether or not this is worthwhile doing, because that's another big part of the decision-making process, given the expenses of going forward on a particular venture, what are the ones that really have the most bang for the buck in the new digital world, and also, what terms would you strike then? What kind of share of revenue would there be, and who would take responsibility for various items within the average budget for developing and producing and exploiting the content. So we may not cover all of that, but we're going to do our best, and we have a very able panel. So I thought I'd introduce each of them. Here next to me is John Bartlett from Kelp Records. John founded Kelp Records in 1994, and it's grown into a management company, Kelp Management, based in Ottawa, managing artists Andy Schaaf and US Girls. John is also the director of Megaphono, an organization focused on spreading Ottawa area music to the world, which held the first edition of an annual music showcase festival in Ottawa in February 2015. He's also the executive director of the Canadian Council of Music Industry Associations and sits on the board of the newly formed Ottawa Music Industry Coalition. John Bartlett, ladies and gentlemen. Next up is Michael Dobbin from Quiet Revolution Pictures. Michael Dobbin is a seasoned feature film producer and distributor based in Ottawa and operating internationally. He's a producer with Quiet Revolution Pictures, a production house specializing in independent international co-production in features. Michael recently co-founded Capital Motion Picture Group, an indie distributor focused on Canadian-driven movies for the Canadian territory. Michael Dobbin, ladies and gentlemen. And on our far end, Scott Simpson from Playbrain's Bitheads. Since co-founding Bitheads 19 years ago, Scott has guided the company to become one of the largest app and enterprise development companies in North America.
That's not true. That absolutely is not true.
Says here. Under his leadership, the company has developed a unique mix of capabilities spanning mobile, games, and enterprise software. Scott has served on several public and private boards and actively donates time to startups and Ottawa's tech community. That, ladies and gentlemen, is Scott Simpson.
Yes. One third of that is true.
All right. Well, I'll edit out the rest. So I thought I'd start by just going through each of you and finding out, maybe, what are the latest and greatest kind of cross-platform content exploitation things that you're encountering, or maybe what's most typical that you're encountering. But I'd love to hear kind of what are things you're dealing with now that maybe are a little newer, you haven't seen in the past. Maybe Scott, you want to?
Oh, sure.
Give it a shot.
Again, I'm mostly here from the game side. And games is a hit-driven business, much like music and movies. But the platforms are rather, I'll call them rigid, but the monetization and how you actually make money on them is very different. And it's not just good enough to have a really good quality product. You need to actually have it monetizing the right way and finding the right audience for the right license you're actually using. So it's the thing that I would say that's changing most is everything's somewhat cyclical, but 6 months ago everything was all free-to-play mobile, and now there's budgets going up in consoles now that there's new consoles out there, so that people are looking again at that, and basically PC is staying. Everybody thought it was dead 4 years ago, and now it's where, not most of the money, but where a good steady selection of the money is, but still how you're actually trying to monetize on those platforms is all very different. So it's not just about having the right license or having the right gameplay or putting out a quality product. It's how you're actually trying to make money off it, because there's so many different ways to try to do that. So there's my non-answer to your question.
That's a great answer. I'm going to follow up on that in a minute, but Michael, I wondered from your perspective, what are you seeing out there?
Well, similarly, a good product doesn't necessarily mean it will find its market in film. So a lot of very similar challenges that way. I think, obviously, now with streaming, with piracy issues, the fact that there's a culture out there that downloading movies is somehow not the same as stealing a DVD from Walmart. That's a challenge. But as far as what's new, obviously there's the Holy Grail. Everyone, when we're talking to independent distributors on the or independent producers on the distribution side, often they want to know, can we get our product onto Netflix? which is the holy grail for Canadian film these days. But that being said, Netflix doesn't necessarily pay the best, and you know, but it's certainly the image of having your film on Netflix's legitimacy. So, you know, the film business is, as it always was, a vanity-driven industry.
Yeah.
Monetizing is, we're finding actually for independent film, the same challenges that are there that have always been there about getting your product out and getting your awareness out there. And we found that in some ways, in fact, DVD is still selling for independent films because consumers that are looking for your film and find it know it's not necessarily going to still be streaming in 6 months or whatever, so they'll actually buy a DVD. So the margins are thin, but that is still an area to explore. So I suppose in previous decades, you know, we would look at how much we could make from the box office and how much we could make from broadcast and maybe home video, but now there's a whole bunch of these little tiny revenue streams from all kinds of different places, which means there's a lot more work to do to get less money. And the curve of the drop in the home DVD home video market and streaming, they haven't kind of met yet, so there's still a huge gap in the revenue that we used to see for films, and you know, so the fact is films have to be made more cheaply now on the independent side. So budget pressures are huge as well.
Yeah.
And as far as new ideas to do with gaming and cross-platform, we're always looking to place a product with different companies. We had a little bit of experimentation with a game to do with a film that we had. The challenge was the film wasn't really super well known, so the game didn't really add a lot of value to it.
Yeah.
And so also finding partners that are, I produce content, I don't know how to produce a game. So we're always looking for someone who can do that side of it and do the app side of it, and you know, partners to work with as opposed to the producer paying a service fee to those companies.
Yeah.
We're really looking to do more of that. We recognize the importance of cross-platform exploitation, but it's sometimes very hard to find put together the teams to put all of those elements in place. Again, a lot more work for a lot less of a return. So we must love this business too.
That's the takeaway. Yeah. And John?
Yeah. I guess so. I mean, my experience is similarly to film, music. You know, in these cross-platform situations, like music is often the thing that comes at the end, where people, you know, and that, you know, especially on the budget side. So yeah, I mean, I've dabbled a little bit in projects here and there, but it's funny you brought up Netflix, because just last week I was engaged in a conversation about a potential project and found out, I mean, we'll get into these terms and that sort of thing, but that the music that they want created for this new project, they actually wanted to own it, you know, ahead of have a songwriter produce some material, but they wanted to own the copyright. So,
okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's always with these, you know, we have a catalog of music that we've worked with and also that we broker that's always available to use, but it's sometimes just running into when you actually look at what the term sheet looks like,
yeah.
And what is required, it's like that. That's often a roadblock for kind of moving ahead. So, yeah, I mean, we've done a little bit in video games and that sort of thing, but often the terms are pretty set on some of the bigger productions that we've been involved with. So,
yeah, take it or leave it.
I think a lot of the time with when you're dealing on sort of lower level with emerging artists, for sure.
Yeah. So, like in the case you're saying, where the company wanted copyright.
Yeah.
What would your response be? Would there be any
stick it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you've got to draw a line. You've got to draw lines, and I don't know. I mean, I think the way that those kinds of assumptions on terms that they can get. I mean, it obviously comes with people that don't work in the music space as much, or just or make assumptions about what.
Yeah.
What they can get, or the value that they would bring, you know, to the artist, that they would want to own this particular
song outright.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I try to stay away from it. I just think that music and culture in general is constantly devalued year on year. That you've got to draw your line somewhere and not play in some of those spaces and do what makes sense and do what respects the artists that are making the music.
Yeah. And so they wouldn't, just again on this point, so they wouldn't go back, like if you were to offer anything, you're still in the midst of it.
No, it's all cooking? Fresh sort of thing last week. So, and I think the music supervisor sort of didn't realize that and was frustrated when he was presented with that. And now is making the argument, you know, what do you expect me to license in this production if these are the terms? So, I think they are often the music supervisors are the people that are, that will place all the music in film and TV shows usually when they are hired to do this job, and some of them have leverage and some of them are told, from the director of the production exactly what they, what they need to do. So anyway, I think it's we will see again.
Yeah, no, it'll be interesting. Let me know. Scott, I wondered about when you were talking about monetizing, because that is, you were saying that's really the make or break on these things, is how you're going to do that. So what kind of arrangements have you been striking to kind of make that doable, to make the thing...
Well, it depends on the platform you're creating for. They're basically, if you think of three big bucks, and by the way, right now I'm just talking about Western monetization, because the whole new frontier would be going east with your products and try to monetize in the east, but we're talking west for now. You're talking both either mobile or PC or console, and on console there's really, it's slightly mildly changing, but there's really only one way to make money on console, really, which is making premium, high quality, high budget type stuff. And on PC, it varies all over the place. You get a little bit more free-to-play things, but still, you're still being driven by dollar purchase on day one, for the most part. Yeah. But on mobile, it's absolutely not that. And there's a bit of a renaissance, if you will, for premium games of paying up front. But if you look at 49 of the top 50 games are still all free-to-play games that are the highest grossing, but you're just doing in-app purchases and buying stuff inside. That really is slowly changing again. It's circling around a bit more to premium. People are getting a lot tired of the pay-to-play type stuff. But how you do that is really depending on what kind of game you're building and what platform you're on. So it really goes all over the map.
Yeah.
I don't have a lot of dots.
Sorry, who's...
I've bought a lot of dots.
You've bought a lot of dots, you can do a lot of stuff. or you either buy a lot of dots or you spend a lot of time earning dots by wasting 12 hours of your day.
Yeah.
And even then, there's premium currencies versus earned currencies, and there's a lot of different ways to try to do that inside, but you'll find actually with a lot of mobile title games used to be, a high budget for a mobile game was $100,000 or something, but now there legitimately are $1 million games plus that are doing well on mobile, but it's some of it's about the game, but a lot of it, the real smarts is not just about making it fun anymore. It's how are you actually going to monetize the thing. So there's streams of people who analyze exactly how you're going to sell this and do A/B testing and say, hey, if I make the wagon red, who's going to buy it? And if I make it blue, who's going to buy it? And then, oh, we sold more blues, we're going to make the wagon blue.
So, wow.
There's just a lot of insanity that goes on under the hood to try to make a game that really used to just be about, hey, this is fun, and now it's, well, how am I going to make money doing that?
Yeah.
But again, it's a business, so.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Supposed to be doing that.
Now, for the content then, and to some extent, I mean, that word is so, it's become almost meaningless in some ways, it's content. But if in your case, are you approached by third parties to develop mobile apps on, or is it stuff that's kind of generated in-house?
Sorry, you mean as far as licenses and stuff?
Yeah, if it is, I'm just wondering in terms of what your, most of your stuff.
It's all over the place. I mean, I'd say by and large, most studios these days, and I know a few of the folks here in this place, are still, everybody wants to do their own IP and make their own thing, but you got to pay the bills, and it's a hit-driven business like everything else, and one out of five might make money or something, and the other four will not. So you do work for Higher Things to actually build games for others. And it's usually for a publisher or something. Or you might occasionally be approached by a license holder to say, look, we're trying to actually make a cross-platform something. How can we actually work a deal to do this?
Yeah.
And then you try to figure out, as Michael said, you know, how who's going to pay for what, and how do you split the revenues, and how do you do whatever, and does it might make sense for one half and not the other, and that's sadly probably most likely the case.
Yeah.
Because somebody, say, and let's pretend for the moment Michael's making the new water movie. I'm not a creative guy, so.
No.
It's a water monster coffee world, and he's... Yes, he's doing Waterworld 2.
Yes, tickets are being sold as we speak.
So the problem is Michael, say, has dumped, you know, $2 million or $10 million or whatever into building a full movie and creating a license. Typically, in a lot of cases when you're getting approached on the game side, it's really from the marketing group of that product says, hey, I've got an extra $500,000 or something to promote the movie.
Yeah.
Movie hasn't gone out yet, but they've sunk all their money. Like, they're not going to pay for development of the game. From a full game perspective, the marketing group typically says, well, I could buy billboards, not buying billboards, I don't know what you do, but they do stuff to sell the movie, but they say, hey, we'll carve out some of that, let's make a mobile game to put out before the game gets out and build some buzz and do whatever. Yeah. And those things never work. They're terrible. They are awful, awful games, because the budgets are usually really way too small, the time frame is really way too little, and you're being shoehorned into a certain game because of the license.
Yeah.
The water monster game, okay, fine, I'm going to make a water monster game, but nobody wants to play a water monster game. But the marketing group at the studio decides that's how we're going to actually try to spend our money. So those games are traditionally just terrible, terrible games. There's rarely ever been a good movie tag. Wait, am I supposed to be saying that?
No.
Some of them are really good, though.
All stays within
this.
Stays within this room.
No, the difference is, and we actually made a big push to actually try to do this before, especially in a city... a city that has a lot of film and game and music together. You can be in a place where you're actually going to be in pre-production on a movie or in production of a movie and decide, hey, we're actually going to try to be smart about this and plan ahead, and the movie's shooting. And so we're talking to one group now who's doing a larger budget movie, you know, that's going to come out in 2 years, but they're actually looking to say, how can we do companion game at the same time, and something that's more like treating the game like an evergreen product and not just has life for 2 weeks before the movie comes out.
Yeah.
Because that's the other thing. You're building a water monster game. It's never intended to make money. It's there for awareness. And the problem with games is, especially a mobile game, there are literally 1,000 new apps go up on the App Store every day. Literally 1,000. I'm not making up a stupid number. It's like 1,000.
Yeah.
How does the water monster game, which is, again, a movie that hasn't come out yet, has no license or brand awareness. The whole point of building the game is to try to do that, but it's one of, there's 999 other things that go out that day, and another 1,000 the day after, and the day after, and the day after. So that's, anyway, those things are doomed to fail. Sorry, I'm supposed to be telling a happy story. anyway, I'm sure that's changing, and things will be great for movies and games going forward.
Now, as far as the game content that you have, whether or not it's generated in house, or you own the content, or you have control anyway of the rights, are you ever going out, or is that?
Oh yeah, no. Certainly, there are cases where we have, you know, the exploitation rights for the stuff that we've actually built, and in a lot of cases, to be 100% fair, opening the kimono. There are times when a license holder will come to you and say, hey, I need to build a water monster game. And they say, okay, I'm just going to reskin this game that I've already done 1,000 times, and it's a match 3 game, and everybody knows how to play those. And fine, we can put that piece of garbage up on the App Store very easy, very cheaply. We would own the rights to the game. They have the rights to the license. We can't do anything with water monster going forward, which is probably good for us because we won't shoot ourselves in the face. But but we actually can then resell that game or do other things in other territories. And then usually you will get into a place where either it's a total work for hire, look, we'll do it for $50,000 or whatever it is, and it's never intended to make money. It's a free game. It's just out there.
Yeah.
But there are times when a license holder will come to us and say, look, we want to build a brand, and we've can't get too specific. Anyway, we did one for a very non-traditional game brand that we spent more than $1 million on building a game for that was intended to make money. So you did get into the negotiation of how things happen and how you actually can exploit that afterwards. And so we still had exploitation rights for the game with that one license. We could then redo that game on whatever platform we wanted and whatever territory we wanted. We just couldn't take that license, obviously, and make a new game. But that one game we negotiate, we could do and put it out wherever we like.
Yeah.
And I know it never made any money.
Okay. But I guess, and it ties in maybe with Michael, with what you're seeking to do in a lot of cases is convince a guy like Scott that, you know what, this thing's got legs.
Yeah.
Right? Like, this isn't just a 2-week flash in the pan. We should be partners on this, because then I don't have to pay you as much. Right? Do you find yourselves in those discussions exactly in those words?
Scott will be very happy to hear that we make a lot of decisions before we even, you know, go out to someone like you about, is this even a game that's a sort of franchisable or...
To be 100% fair, I actually know Michael from like 10 years ago. When was it? 10 years ago?
That would have been 5 years ago, probably.
Again, I'm older, so time flies for me. 5 to 10 years ago, Michael actually came to our studio because we did game stuff and basically said, look, we have a new title we're going to try to put out. How can we try to... And that was before you were still... The script was done, but nothing... It wasn't in production or anything.
That's right. And it was only 200 games a day went out.
Yeah, only a couple hundred. Actually, I don't even think mobile was huge then. I think we were actually looking at a full PC game. And the whole point at the time was we went through, okay, well, this is what it's going to cost to do. It didn't work out because it was, well, I'm going to have to invest a whole bunch of money to build a thing for a license that nobody knew at the time. But again, we're trying to keep it sane or whatever. But then it was like, well, can you kick in money for development? The answer is, well, no, because you're spending money on the film. So it's like, can we share the risk on building this thing out? And ultimately I said, I'm a dick, and I said no. But the point is, it was attempted
to be
done.
You probably saved us all a lot of money.
Well, <maybe. laughs> I know I saved me a lot of money. But at the time, it was a sane effort to try to say, fine, we can actually build this thing out and try to build something a little different. So it was actually, it wasn't a, look, we've already got this thing in the can and I got 50 grand, what can I do?
I mean, I think part of the, to answer your question, part of our assessment of a project is, again, we talk about putting in all of this work and what are the returns worth. It's got to be the right kind of project to justify that.
Yeah.
So for example, if we had a children's movie, maybe we'd look at doing some sort of game that would...
An introspective drama about suicide or something.
That's
is
right.
Probably not a
it's
big seller.
It's not going to sell well in theaters or in the gaming world. So
I say that, but I can actually think of one right now that almost is like that, but that's fine.
But a lot of the movies we get, especially Canadian independent films on the distribution side, are just not going to be worth... Some of them don't even bother with a website. You know, you put up a Facebook page, and to be honest, it's just as effective as building a website. Some of the titles we have, if there's, you know, some movie stars attached, certainly when we're producing a film, if we know that we're going to have a certain cast, we'll look at it. But there's still, if it's an adult drama, there's not really any reason to put any kind of companion product out there. I mean, if there's a book, we might do some sort of cross-promotion with the publisher, or... if there's music in the soundtrack, we might talk to the label about, you know, co-marketing some things. But there's a lot of work involved in doing cross-platform, and frankly, the returns are just not there for the most part.
Yeah.
I think even as you hit the nail on the head, even the big water monster movie, even if it's Universal Pictures does it, they're just dumping that as a marketing tool. They're not doing it as a business venture. It's only there to support the movie franchise. So we try to assess things very early on, and it's very rare that we have a project that we think there might actually be something to explore there.
And does that affect, I mean, right away when dealing with the producer on that, I mean, with your distributor hat on, are you then already thinking in terms of, you know, getting your money back on this, or, you know, making it worth your while to take it out when it comes to deciding, you know, whether or not you're going to push for ancillary rights and those type of thing, that plays a role then, and then?
Yeah, so on the short answer for the distribution side is we only handle Canada, and the margins are so thin in Canada, there's never gonna be a case for us to put money into cross-platform to release a Canadian movie. Or it would be very rare if it happened. On the production side, when we're looking at, we have worldwide rights in something, so there might be a little, there's more likelihood, we have a bigger market that we could potentially recoup from, but it's still a question of, is this a product that could be a franchise that could go out over various different platforms? And usually the answer is going to be no. You won't know until if the film does a fantastically successful run, oh, let's talk about adapting to a TV series. And then, you know, then maybe we'll start looking at some other platforms. But you don't really know till the spaghetti hits the wall what's going to stick. So to add that layer is not yet feasible in most cases. And again, as a producer, I mean, you wouldn't believe the stuff I get pitched in a week. I mean, we're a small company that most people have never heard of, so I don't know where people find us. But, you know, I am dying to get a sci-fi, you know, script or a family. I mean, children's entertainment. We never get pitched this stuff. It's quite often, what did you say, existential, suicidal, you know.
The water monster could be from space, and he's got little kitty.
And,
little,
you know,
ice cubes. It's a family movie and sci-fi.
You should write me a script. This would be great.
Yeah.
Work for hire, though.
Yeah. It's decided.
Yeah. The cool monster the in monster. A world covered in water.
And John, from your end, not so much necessarily about cross-platforming, but I just wondered, in terms of getting the music out there now in the new digital space, places like Spotify, et cetera. I mean, how's that affecting your decision making now?
Yeah, I mean, these are the conversations you get into all the time, music to stream everywhere, to stream, to put the record up a week or two before, or to keep it off the streaming for the first few days. And I don't know, it's constantly like reevaluating what's better to do. It's interesting, just having gone through the process with this new US Girls record. She's on 4AD, which is a pretty reputable British indie that has, you know, a great team across the world. And they're really not into the pre-streaming. So I was impressed, actually. I mean, they've got their people inside keeping track of, you know, when is it leaked, or has it leaked, and even each, you know, for the press people or anyone that's getting pre-review copies, you know, it's not like the old days where you mail out a bunch of CDs to people. You've got watermarked MP3s that are going out to each individual, and I mean, really, the process for the album. I think the first video came out in the spring, and the record just came out on the 25th of September. So there were three singles through that time, and they didn't do. There was no pre-stream. There was no NPR advance listen the week before. It was just the day it came out. It was on everything.
Yeah.
And it was an interesting approach. I mean, I've always, with our own record label in the past, it's just sort of, you know, everything is sort of seen as marketing. You know, the more people want to put it up on their platforms, or if CBC wants to pre-stream or anything like that, we're just, you know, all of that is going to bring attention to it, which will help when the tour dates happen and more people will come out and see the show. So,
are there limits on the pre-streaming? Like, what would there be a negotiation as to?
Typically it's like a week or two before where they'll do an advance album stream. You see that a lot with CBC in Canada and NPR in the US, and you'll give somebody an exclusive So I don't know. I mean, I've always been more of a mind of just get it out everywhere. But then when you get the Excel sheet with thousands of entries from Spotify at the end of the month and look at the income associated with it, you just wonder, is it worth it or not? I mean, I think the argument in the industry is always that, you know, eventually you will see income, and it's about volume and all these things. But I'm still not totally there in terms of seeing that. I just see 0.0015 cents for a stream in Denmark, and you know, if you didn't, you know, you wonder if you were really sort of adamant about keeping it off of streaming, or only allowing one song to be streamed or downloaded, one or two songs on a record, would someone go and pay the $9.99, and I don't know. I think that I don't think for most of the artists I work with that we're at the volume where we can, that decision really makes a huge monetary difference at this point. But I think it's interesting watching what, you know, the 4ADs and different labels like that, how they manage it. You know.
Yeah.
So.
And with regard to other income streams, looking at syncing, have you been approached by different platforms for maybe video games or otherwise for putting songs in? Is that and when you're in those discussions, is it kind of seen as a bit of a loss leader to get music out there, or is that more of a money making?
My own experiences I haven't had a lot of them. We've had some music placed in video games, and I think there were sort of bigger productions like Shaun White's Skate.
Oh yeah.
And really the terms are pretty set. I mean, it's not a lot of money. It's exposure, I've seen some artists, I guess, use those things as stepping stones to raising their profile. But sometimes you see these lists of your credits, and it's, what does that have to do with like your songwriting? And
yeah.
So it's always I think a lot of it's interesting. Like that type of game where it's part of the games that have like the soundtracks in behind. Or those driving games. Like, I love the way there's really interesting things going on, I think, with music and some of the music that's used in those, where they'll get really indie or really obscure, and I think that's great. I guess we haven't. My experiences with it is that there's not really a lot of negotiation when you get the term sheet. It's sort of like, here's our 2 or 4 page thing. We need it in perpetuity on all platforms everywhere, all territories in the universe, here's a few $100.
And I guess
buddy.
And I guess in some cases, then that would depend, I imagine, on the kind of leverage your artist has, right? Is this an artist who just wants to get their music heard while, kids are sitting down playing NHL 2015 or something, and getting that, hearing that song, like, hey, that's a pretty cool song, I gotcha. while they're playing, or is it something where maybe it won't be as promotional, I guess.
Yeah. I haven't had any personal examples where it sort of led to something else. Kind of part of a pack of a playlist of, a huge chunk of songs and an interesting talking point at panels.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
You get another one right after this? Yeah.
But, I mean, I know that OMDC often talks about the example of like Jim Guthrie, who's a friend, and sort of his experience in, like, I think those kind of uses and those kind of engagements and cross platform are really interesting, where he's just this, this indie artist that did sort of singer-songwriter stuff and was getting into composing for film and ads, and they sort of made up their own, they kind of made up their own rules, small indie game company, sort of smaller regional artist, and created something really, really unique. That's totally, the soundtrack and the music in that game is it's incredible. It's like part of the whole, it's really really at the forefront, rather than something in the background on a playlist.
Yeah, so. I haven't seen the game, but we had Nathan Vella from Capybara Games was at our Toronto panel, and it was James Guthrie, who did the music for the game, and the deal they struck with him was, well, you can keep rights to the music, and we'll have rights to the game, and that way you can take your royalties off of the music and use it elsewhere. And that way it became more cost effective for the company to do that. And I guess it was the type of game that was, as you say, the music's so much part of it, and he thought it was cool, I guess.
Yeah.
It was kind of like, it worked for both of them. Otherwise, they would have never been able to afford that.
Yeah, and I mean, the great thing about that, too, is him being able to retain his rights. I mean, he went out and did a double vinyl gatefold, this beautiful thing, package, and integrating the artwork from the game. So it was like, all these, video game folks. This is like their first LP that they bought. These kids are like, "Whoa, I need a record player now." So I love that. I mean, that's amazing. That's like, apex of like what you can do with, when you take it, think about it a little differently, and choose or make up your own rules.
Yeah, so. Yeah, it was a win-win in that case. Yeah. 5 minutes. Just want to also, Michael, when we were talking about, negotiating the terms from a producer's standpoint, and I guess. And just following up when we were talking about when you see that there's a particular content that you've got that you think to yourself, yeah, this could have its own life. And when you're negotiating with a distributor, in this case, maybe it's for worldwide rights, mm-hmm. and they're saying, you know, we want these ancillary rights because they always do. Mm-hmm. But as Scott was pointing, a lot of the times, you know, they'll blow part of their P&A budget on, you know, putting out some crappy version, video game version of this content, whatever it is, and you're thinking to yourself, no, this doesn't have to be the Water Monster game. This could be something way cooler. Do you then fight for it on that basis?
I guess if they want those rights, I put them on the spot and I say, you want video game rights. Okay, well, are you planning to exploit them? And if so, is that going to be considered gross revenue that's going into our collection account? Because if you're not, why don't you just, we'll strike that out and you can let me keep them.
Yeah.
And quite often if you get a sales agent, for example, a middle person, and they want to get those rights so they can then market them on, and I equally say to them, you know, do any of your clients do anything with those rights? Because I don't want them to build a game as a big P&A cost that's coming out of my revenue later. So I generally will just ask them directly, if you're not planning to do anything, let me keep them. And if something comes up, let me know. I'm probably willing to give them to you.
Yeah.
But I'd need to know what's involved here and, you know, that it's... that's the best way, is to put them on the spot. And in the past, I've found it comes in the standard agreement. And they'll always say, oh, that's just our standard agreement. And I say, okay, I'm just going to scratch it out, and I'm going to initial it. You could initial it, and we're done. And they'll do it. Most times they won't.
Yeah.
Or let me check with, you know, Dr. So-and-so, and it's the CEO, and they'll come back, and usually they'll be fine with it. And sometimes if they don't get back to me, I just scratch it out anyway and send them the copy, and they can come back to me. Or in the meantime, they have a signed copy. People are inherently lazy. They'll just go ahead and put it through.
Yeah.
So I've managed to keep my ancillary rights on a few projects that way. Not that anything has... that those rights have ever been worth anything, but I have them.
Yeah.
Have them in my library.
That's right. That's right. Have you looked at reversion rights sometimes with that type of thing, or you've been successful in just keeping it out, or?
Oh, just keep it out entirely. I mean, usually the contract itself will have a reversion. I've never signed any in perpetuity agreements. There's just no reason.
I meant with respect to the, you know, like as in you've got a year to use this. These rights, you know, if you want to walk the walk, that's fine. We'll put these rights in. You got a year, but if you're not in a year, then they come back to me.
I think probably, from a legal point of view, it'd be great to work in another clause with another term for that clause and all that kind of stuff. But I think generally, just say, come back to me if you want them.
If you're doing that, that's
separate
working,
deal. Yeah, that's normally how we would do it. I have never been put against the wall on that issue anyway. I think probably the buyer is. Or the licensor is going to know as well as I do, they're probably not going to have much of a value for this particular project.
Yeah, no, I'm always amazed by the power of simply asking the question oftentimes, right? You actually say, so can we just have those? Because are you going to be using them?
What are you going to do with them?
Yeah, and they actually have no answer to that. It's in our hard drive.
Yeah.
And then... Right, and then
when I've been on the distribution side, we always ask for them. I always read it and I'm like, oh yeah, I'm asking for those. And quite often the producers will say, do you need them? And I say, well, probably not. But if I did get an agreement where I could license gaming rights to somebody, I would put that into general revenue, and we'll put that in the contract so it's clear. If I sell the gaming rights for $5 or $5,000, that'll go into general revenue and be treated the same as revenue from the movie.
Yeah.
And they're usually okay with that, as long as they know that you're not putting it in there to keep it in your back pocket or to find a way around. We try to be transparent, and I am always ready for the question when people ask. Other times they say, you just keep them, just scratch it out.
Yeah.
Keep it simple.
It works. It is time now for Q&A. Any questions we're going to have? I think we've got a microphone right there. The lovely Jen Brown. Any questions?
I'll ask a question.
Okay.
Too bad Nathan's not here, because we've been talking about him and his game. It seems that the ingredient with Capybara Games and Jim Guthrie is trust, which is a Jim Guthrie song, actually. So if that's an interesting new model for negotiating, is having a relationship of trust before you go into it, so that people aren't entering an agreement saying, I'm going to get as much as I can, I'm going to take as much as I can. How do people in your industries move towards that? Or can you? Is this too philosophical a question? I don't know.
I would suggest that legal agreements exist, because trust is fun to think about while you're starting something. But your legal agreements, for the most part, you never even worry about until there's a problem. And there's always a problem when trust is broken. So every agreement you enter into, there is a mutual trust with what you're doing, but yeah, when that breaks down, you need a legal agreement. So I'll be the wet blanket and say trust is for suckers. And legal agreements are good.
And lawyers are good people.
Yeah, there you go. Everyone loves a lawyer.
I'll throw that in. Yeah.
I probably shouldn't have shot down the first question. That's a great question. I meant to start with saying that's a great question.
It is.
I mean, can I just add to that really quickly? Is I think I'll just add one point to that, Jen. I think even when you have a watertight contract, when you get into a dispute, the contracts are never clear enough. So
that's why there's a water monster.
That's why we need
you call
water
it
monsters.
Watertight, but the water monster always
lawyers
monster.
And water monsters. There you go.
Hi there. Just following up on that question of trust. Do you think legislative change can help? Like, for example, for music, if there was a statutory rate for when your songs are reused in a game or something like that. Because it seems like, to me, a lot of money is wasted on lawyers. And if, the success of platforms like YouTube to show if you have a framework in place for reuse, everyone makes more money.
Yeah, I mean, I think the rates are very low. The streaming rates are established, I don't even know how initially, with YouTube and Spotify. It's usually the market leader comes out and makes up some rate, and based on what they are guessing, projecting forward 5 or 10 years, and then the market adopts that. I mean, that's what happened with iTunes as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, sure. If there was a higher rate, that would be great. That would be awesome if 0.001 was 0.01. But
then you'd have to get past the powerful lobby on the other side that would be saying, no. And then we don't have the margins for that.
And then you couldn't click through the ad after 5 seconds. You'd have to wait a full minute or something for your pre-roll ads.
Yeah.
But I think legislating it is just going to add to the whole culture of piracy. People don't like rules. And if there's legislation, people are just going to go, screw that, man. I'm going to just download it anyway. You know, we've learned from, recent CRTC hearings and things that really rules are one thing, but how do you enforce rules, and how do you enforce, is the government going to audit everybody's books to make sure they're paying artists? Well, I think it would be very impractical, but I like the sentiment that something should be done.
I think there's also the very realistic concern, especially when it comes to music and movies, and someday it'll come for games. It's sort of tried, but it's not there. Is from the consumer side, you're getting to a place where, you don't buy CDs anymore. You go to Spotify or iTunes Music or Google Play or whatever. And on movie side, you go to Netflix or you go to Xiaomi or you go to Crackle or whatever those things are, Crave. On the game side, it still is individual purchase, sort of, but as I already told you, the monetization is so screwed up. At some point, there will be an eat-your-everything video game package that'll cost $10 a month, and people will flood to that, and then gamers will be in the same place that everybody else is, and we'll be getting 0.0015 cents per play, which already exists in some cases, and it's been tried a couple of times with OnLive and other places. But it really will get successful one day, and we'll be in the exact same place, because consumers just get to a place where they want all they can eat for $10. They've now gotten used to, it used to be they needed a physical disc because then I can hold it and it won't be taken away from me. But now they're getting used to Spotify. Oh God, this is easy. I don't have to actually go buy anything. I can actually just search. Oh my, I can play. I can actually look at something or go to Netflix or whatever. And it'll happen with games at some point, and it's just a drive to the bottom for price, and everybody's gonna be clamoring for their 0.0015 cents. And it's not going to be a $10 a pop industry anymore. And that's just, consumers will drive everything. And whether it's legislated or not, you're just going to be searching for eyeballs for your stream. And that's why in music you can tour. And I have the solution to your streaming and Netflix is, you know, live performance in-house of the Water Monster movie. We'll actually get your little things together.
Available? Is the Water Monster available?
Well, it's a bit of a setup. It's a bit of a chore. We haven't figured out all the problems yet.
So I just wanted to address the question you asked, Omid, because there's a whole organization that exists that people don't necessarily know about called the Copyright Board of Canada. And there is where representative groups like collectives who represent artists go and argue with companies who use their content about royalty rates, and that's how they're actually set. So there is a government part of this process. It'd be great to see more creators learn about that process and be active in the process. It sets the floor and the ceiling at the same time. So, you know, if you're independent and you're not part of a collective, maybe look into that. Maybe, you know, arm your artists with that kind of thinking. In the video game industry, we have a tariff on music, but we don't have a lot else, and we seem to be a bit allergic to tariffs, which is complicated and historical, which is fine. But there is a part of the process I think the government can play in this, and we need to educate ourselves as well about it, too. So I just wanted to raise that. Mm-hmm.
And I think with the Copyright Board, it would be great if they filled the seats that haven't been filled and they took more than, you know, a little less than 5 to 7 years to make decisions. So I think that, I mean, part of the problem with, you know, it's constantly trying to get them to move, and by the time they make decisions, the technology is already obsolete. So, yeah, that's a whole other panel.
I know you optioned a book away from everywhere. I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about what the process was and anything that came up in the negotiations making your film based on the book.
Sure. So this is a feature film called Away From Everywhere that was filmed in Newfoundland past April based on a book. And I wasn't actually initially involved in the negotiation of the option, the book that was my co-producers who'd had the property for a while. So I came on more as a co-production side of it. I did have some say when we were negotiating the sort of renewals and the final work. It was a fairly straightforward process. I mean, I think, I can't say too much about it, but to me there were no surprises there, I suppose. In any negotiation on an existing property, there's always the speculation of what the artist or their representative feels the property is worth and what they think it's going to make, and then what the producer thinks it's worth and what they're going to make, and there's always a huge gap between. So being able to find what that is and to convince each other that this is a good deal is always going to be the process. And I think certainly the book is a lesser known book. It wasn't a, you know, top 10 bestseller. It's done very well, but, you know, I think we were both sides were fairly aware of the risk that was being taken, so it was a fairly amicable process.
I think as long as you get to a place, getting back to trust, the writer of that book's expelled their heart, soul, and energy to write the book. The book was completed. Then the movie has to happen. The person who is invested in creating that product, a complete product, has done the blood, sweat, and tears for 1 year, 2 years, 10 years, I don't know how long, but then has to go to somebody to say, I need you to trust that this is a good idea and spend a whole bunch more money on my work, but everybody overvalues what you've created because you're the one who knows how hard it was to do that thing. And then you got somebody waltzing in and saying, well, I'm only going to spend this or that or whatever. Well, are you kidding? I mean, this thing should be huge. It should be whatever because it's my baby. It's my thing. It's, well, no, you've got to find the right balance of, yeah, you've sunk a bunch of money and cost and effort into creating something. I have to do the same thing on the new thing. So you got to trust me that I need this for not a great advance or big deal of money up front. We all need to share the risk and do whatever. And that's where you do need to have trust that you're dealing with somebody reputable. But then you need a really solid legal agreement afterwards to make sure nobody...
When you can't agree on the trust side, you usually defer that to the profit share. Because quite often there's no profit share. But if there is, and the film or whatever film you're talking about, it makes a lot of money, well, then then you can argue about who should have had what, but it usually doesn't get to that. So I'm always very generous with the profit share as a bargaining tool because in film specifically, you're not certain that... Look, if the film made $10 million and I gave away an extra $500,000, well, I just made $10 million on the movie, so,
yeah.
You know, that hasn't happened yet, though.
That's right.
Michael, can you mention who the publisher of the book was and the author, if you have that?
Yeah, the publisher's Breakwater Books, and the author's Chad Pelly.
Is that a East Coast publisher?
Yes.
Okay.
That's right.
So yeah. A Canadian-owned publishing company.
I believe so.
Excellent.
Yeah. Check out the book. It's a good one.
Make a good game.
Great game.
When's the movie come out?
The film should be released sometime in 2016. Don't know yet.
Okay.
Don't know yet.
Yeah, hi. I'm just curious. When you get your 0.001 rates from Spotify or something, are there any sort of global regional rate differences? Are you paid sort of one fee, and irrespective of what they charge in the different, like in Britain versus Canada versus US?
No, it's different. I mean, it's more, I think it's a bit currency driven. I mean, think of iTunes, it's generally $9.99. So if it's £9.99, then you'd get more than, if it's $9.99 Canadian. So yeah, I mean, it varies, and it's like thousands of lines of thing. I could spend a couple days looking at one of them, but really it's like the amount of money that is that I don't even dig into them that much, because it's sort of, oh, okay, I assume this is correct, but it's not worth my time to even look into this much further besides, okay, there's my direct deposit.
Those six streams that add up to 8 cents or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Is going to cost you more than that just to figure out if that's the right number, because the difference is not going to be $8.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
going to be 0.00005 cents or whatever.
But yes, there are regional differences. Scandinavia stream pays better.
Any other? No more questions. Oh, over here.
Hi, my name is Hoda from GAPC Entertainment here in Ottawa, and we produce children's content as one of the main things that we do. And I wanted to come back to Scott's comment on the different ways you can monetize, cross-platform content. So when we do a children's series, we do start right from the very beginning thinking about the game or that other piece of content. We work with a company who will, create the game with us. So we start early on. And because it's children's content, and I think there's a growing appetite for especially educational content, which is what we do, we're still struggling with how to monetize. I mean, we think we do all the right things, but obviously we're not, because we are making those 8 cents that you're talking about. And we do social media strategy, we do publicity, we try and build brand awareness, we try and get our broadcasters to publicize the content and the series that airs on TV and the other pieces of content that are coming out. And still, we haven't found that combination. So I'm really curious as to what insight you might be able to give as to different ways one can monetize. And our things come out on like mobiles and on different platforms, right?
Sure. Again, the unfortunate part is your story is very common with 999 other people out of 1,000. And it's really tough to hit, right? Especially when you're in the kids' space, where you're really advertising to the parents, who are the ones who are going to spend the money, but the kids need to be the ones who are engaged. So doing social media with a kids' game is tough, because the kids are frequently forbidden from social media stuff.
Right?
Yeah, so you're really selling to the parents for something their kids are going to like, or they're going to force onto their kids, which is, I don't have kids, so I'm not sure how this actually works, but I hear it works great. So it is tough. Again, the biggest thing that you try to do, and again, you're dealing with a brand that you already have, and I think the most interesting thing we've seen, and brands, unfortunately, are getting to rule the world more and more. Whatever the Nestle Water Monster, it wouldn't even be the Water Monster movie, it would be the Nestle Water Monster movie. Or Nestle would have a lot of product placement in with their water everywhere, and somehow it will defeat the wrong kind of water later in the movie. Anyway, brands have a lot of money, and they're the ones who pay for a lot of content. So what we're seeing actually, and even in kids' space, is sort of, I call them co-branding things. You have the license you're creating, but if you're actually going to be able to put a kids brand in it or a related brand to it, they'll actually not just put some money into production, but actually try to give you a bit of a lift with their social media reach, which again, is a little iffy as it is. I mean, I still don't know, who likes the Nestle Facebook page? Why do you like the Nestle Facebook page? What do they do for you? Who follows Nestle on Twitter? I do not understand. But they do have a Twitter account, I'll guarantee you. By the way, nothing against Nestle, just happens to be the product here. But if you go to I would like somebody to tell me, how many followers does Nestle have on Twitter? And it'll be in the hundreds of thousands of whatever. So they'll put out, hey, you've now done a deal with Nestle and the kids game somehow. They'll just actually provide some lift and do some things for you to do to a deal to try to build the product is a good way to try to mitigate at least the money you're going to lose on the game. It's not going to really help you make money, but it's going to help you lose less money. That's not a very encouraging thing to say either. The other thing I would encourage you to do, though, speaking of OMDC, is there are multiple programs that they actually have, obviously, and I'm sure sometime maybe today, do you talk about it at the IOM regions? Is OMDC talking about? Anyway, they have IDM and they have OIDMTC. They have lots of different things to actually try to help you get a product out there and actually do something to encourage you to actually do some creative things. So obviously, if you haven't been, but I'm sure you have been, check those guys out too. But anyway, sadly, it'll all come down to keep trying different stuff, but you're one of a thousand every day you put something out, and trying to actually capture imagination is not easy in any industry. Like any creative industry, it's tough.
If you spent the same number of dollars on lottery tickets, you probably have a better return.
The other thing I'll add is the only lesson we've sort of learned over the years is, and it's maybe just slightly different now, but it always is more or less the same, any dollar you spend outside of the platform you're selling on is wasted money. So if you're on, you know, if you do a PC game, you're going to try to really have somebody be able to click and be able to buy that game right away. Doing TV ads or doing billboards or, again, what with the billboards? Nobody does billboards. That's wasted money because people just see a brand and then they forget about it because they see the next one and the next one. You need to actually have an engaged click and, like, buy here type stuff. That's the only thing that sort of works, and it doesn't really. Of course it does work. Everything's great.
That is all the time we have, so I want to thank, join me in thanking my panel.
Thanks for that.
John Bartlett, Michael Dobbin, Scott Simpson, let's hear it for them. That was